Well, welcome to the midday, he said.
It's Norman, believe it or not, and Vicky. And we have a very special guest with us, a violinist who has carved out a fabulous career, Cho Liang Lin. You're in Madison this weekend to perform with the Madison Symphony, a great concerto, the Beethoven concerto.
Well, welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me here. It's my only second visit to Madison, Wisconsin. And last time wasn't quite as cold as this one, but
we do what we can.
Or snowy, but, probably.
Yes, much more snow on the ground this time. But I'm so glad to be back here.
We're glad you're here with us today.
Well, the last time we talked, and I sounded much better, you had just released an LP of the Haydn
Remember
Violin
those
Concerto.
Days?
Yes, LPs. Yeah, do we remember LPs? Now we're on to downloads and iPods and whatnot, and we're harking back to the days of the record, vinyl
that's
disc.
That's how long it's been, and you describe the second movement of it as one unending song. I remember that.
You have very good memory. Yeah, indeed, I still think so. The second movement is really magical work, beautiful. It's the solo violin just spins out this endless melody, and it's gorgeous.
And it sounds like this, with Cho Liang Lin as the violinist.
That was beautiful, the second movement of the Haydn Concerto, Violin Concerto No. 1 in C major. Cho Liang Lin, our guest, was the soloist there with the Minnesota Orchestra and Neville Mariner conducting. A beautiful piece, and I'm reminded that Simon, the conductor Simon Rattle, was noticed to lecture the audience on proper technique for stifling a cough. And you have some entertaining observations about something else that sometimes turns up in the concert hall, and that's the cell phone.
Mm. Well, yes, that's right. On the way into the studio, I was telling you this very unusual performance in which the audience and the musicians led by Gidon Kremer were in a usual mode of concert, and suddenly a cell phone went off in the middle of the performance, and the audience gasped. And then one of the musicians took the phone out of his pocket and began to chat. And the audience were absolutely confounded. And then a minute or so later, another phone went off, and more gasps. And then another musician took the phone out of the pocket and commenced talking. And after a while, more phones went off. And then, of course, that was part of the piece, as it turned out. The composer had asked for cell phones to be dialed. And, of course, I was thinking, hearing that story, is that what happens if you have a concert or hall where cell phone reception is not particularly good and you cannot actually complete the dialing? Well, that would be a dilemma, wouldn't it?
It would be a problem for that piece. So sometimes
keep things quiet otherwise,
welcome,
though.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then there was a very cute story, too, where the Juilliard String Quartet was in a performance in New York not so long ago. And there was a really odd noise that emanated from the stage, and the musicians stopped, and the first violinist, Joe Smirnoff, started fumbling around in his pocket, and out came a metronome that he was busy tuning and playing, practicing with this metronome backstage, and he just tucked in his pocket, and when he shifted his weight around in his seat during the performance, it triggered the metronome to start, and there was this tick, 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 and then, so
that wasn't supposed to be part of the
that's
piece.
Right, it was I know Joe Smirnoff, and he was a little embarrassed by it, but he said it was all in good fun, good natured anyway.
There's so many possibilities for that kind of problem now.
There are. What a world we live in. Well, I've been reading that you're a student of Dorothy DeLay, and that who's, of course, an extraordinary teacher of so many musicians. And what you took from her was her sense of organization. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Dorothy DeLay was an extraordinary teacher, yes, absolutely. And she taught a score of wonderful violinists and who continue her very distinct line of thought to this day. The idea she imparted to me very clearly was the idea that violin playing can be broken down into components. And no student, as long as there's some semblance of basic talent, no violin student couldn't at least get to a certain level of playing. No one is hopeless. And she was this eternal optimist. I loved her outlook on life. I wish I had that quality. But nonetheless, she was able to break my playing down into components and fix those components that are not quite working and put them back together. And she was able to later on challenge me to break someone else's playing down into components. And I realized that what she was doing was not only teaching me, but teaching me to think and teaching me to teach myself. And that has become a very strong component, a very important component in my own teaching, which I do plenty nowadays. So in thinking about Dorothy DeLay's legacy, I think one of her strongest suits was the idea of that a person's violin playing can be analyzed and can be enhanced when you think about it in great detail.
You were invited to play with the Berlin Philharmonic, and she, on your behalf, turned it down when you were 18.
Yeah, of course. She was absolutely right in that I wasn't ready to play with the Berlin Philharmonic. But of course, you know, you have to imagine an 18-year-old, 19-year-old sitting in the Juilliard cafeteria. You want the bragging rights to tell all your classmates and schoolmates who were willing to be near you that, hey, you know, guess what? I just went and played with the Berlin Philharmonic and Riccardo Muti. Now, you try to top that, you know. But of course, that was all very juvenile, but that's what we were. We were kids. But she was very wise in very diplomatically declining that invitation for me. And I've become wiser because of that.
Well, shall we hear some more music here? We have a new Naxos, relatively new, I guess, a year and a half old, from Naxos, of concertos by Vivaldi, of course, including the Four Seasons. And, since it's winter, why not? Why not the first movement of Winter with Cho Liang Lin? And the group you're performing with here, Sejong.
It's a wonderful conductorless string ensemble based in New York, made out of top-flight soloists, competition winners, and professors. They're generally young, I would say in their 20s to 30s. Beautifully integrated ensemble. And the linchpin in this particular recording is the harpsichordist Anthony Newman, who, mm-hmm. whom I respect greatly for his knowledge and abundant energy and a real source of inspiration in Baroque music.
Wonderful sound. Sejong, Anthony Newman at the harpsichord, and violinist Cho Liang Lin. The first movement of Vivaldi's Winter Concerto from the Four Seasons.
Very convincing.
What a wonderful sound that is. A very...
Chattering teeth and
yes.
slipping on ice.
They're wonderful. Wonderful sonnets written, I think, by Vivaldi himself to accompany these four concerti in the Four Seasons. Very imaginative.
I was also reading about your instrument, well, the several instruments that you've had over the years, and one that was in a bank vault for 30 years or something, and how that affected the sound.
Well, it didn't do the violin a whole lot of good.
Need to be played, right?
Well, yes and no. To be absolutely honest, some great instruments should be left alone because you know, when you play them, there is some wear and tear that will go with it, you know, because you're touching it and, you know, any mm-hmm. piece of wood will get worn out. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, when we sweat, when we play, you know, sweat always contains a little bit of acid. That wears away at the wood and the varnish slightly. But to be absolutely honest, most of the violins, even the greatest ones, Stradivari's and Guarneri's, they are somewhat worn anyway, because from day one when they leave the shop, they're played. And the very first, probably 20 to 30 years of all these great violins' existence, that's where the most amount of wear and tear takes place, because violinists want to play a great violin, and they're not to be put in a display case from day one and to be admired only, because, mm-hmm. you know, in those days, these great violin makers made them for players. Some Stradivari's were commissioned by the royal courts, and they were better preserved because the royal family tend not to play instruments and will have only occasional court concerts. So there are some specimens left. They're beautiful, really beautiful. But my philosophy is that a great violin, of course, should be maintained, should be treated with love and care, but their greatest asset is their sound. And if they're not heard, it's a great pity.
Mm. And the bow, you use a different bow for a different season?
Different bows. The great bows, they have different characteristics. Some are lighter, clear, I would say more classical. Some are heavier, stronger, and more robust, and perhaps better suited for a big concerto or even some bows that I consider even too strong for Mozart, but perfectly well suited for Shostakovich, for instance. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the work, and I would choose my bows accordingly.
The work, not the season.
Do you prefer to play a piece that has very explicit instructions or something with broader possibilities?
Oh, it's a good question. I've worked with enough contemporary composers now to see a very wide range of styles, and I can only imagine that these composers are a reflection of composers of the past, in that some want very clear instructions left behind, and some prefer to have the interpreters roam a little more. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. Like, you have very explicit instructions from, say, Beethoven, Brahms, and sometimes with hardly anything from Mozart and Schubert. You have to use your imagination. But I know one thing now from working with living composers is that one must not take these instructions as ironclad rules, that they must be observed at all cost. In other words, if you see a marking of piano, does that mean that you go very soft or you go relatively soft? Or you do something that's in relation to all the bars around you. In other words, there's no absolute in music at all. And you, as an interpreter, must judge, but judge judiciously as to what you think makes the best sense and what conveys your feelings the most clearly to your audience. And that's the ultimate goal. Because if you take all instructions as absolutes, then the music really becomes rather dead.
Yeah, so it theoretically would sound the same every time, theoretically, mm-hmm. if that were possible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you find it difficult to balance your concert career with your faculty position at Rice University?
Yeah, and to top it off, I maintain a studio at the Juilliard School.
Oh, my.
So I do commuting between Houston and New York, and then on concert tours on top. Yes, it is difficult because I have to find time to practice, to learn new pieces, to maintain my chops, but also to make sure my students get quality time with me, to also answer their questions. And eventually, when they grow and they become professionals, I often write letters of recommendation for them. I give them career advice. And all these things take time. So management of time has become very crucial for me. And I have a family. I have a 7-year-old daughter at home, and I want to devote good quality time with her and my wife as well. But, you know, in the end, you realized, yes, even though you might lose a little sleep from time to time, but you see students grow up and you see them mature and become their own and they succeed in professional lives. It's wonderful. It's worth all the effort.
I'm glad to hear there's a payoff.
Well, the payoff will be on the concert stage here at the Overture Hall Friday night at 7:30, Saturday night at 8 o'clock, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30, the Beethoven Violin Concerto with our guest Cho-Liang Lin and the Madison Symphony Orchestra and the Janáček Symphoniata, which I don't think is performed a lot.
It's not a lot, but it's a great piece.
Big, brassy piece. Yeah. Music by Puccini and Mendelssohn, too. So,
a lot to look forward to.
A lot to look forward to. And I guess if I could ask you one more question, why do you think people should call and pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio? Why is classical music on public radio important?
I think, first of all, on a very fundamental level, great music is the underpinning of human achievement. I don't want to sound very grandiose about it, but it is true. I think it's the most expressive form of art. And also think that when we have the chance to hear great music being played on the air, is wonderful. I mean, that's how I grew up in Taiwan. My parents didn't have access to live concerts. We couldn't go and hear the Madison Symphony or the New York Philharmonic. Radio was where I got my music. I heard so much great stuff on the radio. I heard Toscanini's performances. I heard Bernstein. I heard all these great musicians. And it was very inspiring. And I couldn't imagine why anybody wouldn't want to be inspired or to be comforted by great music. And, you know, if public radio is the source of that, go for it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Taking time.
Thank you for having me.